Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. This is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry, where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives to help prepare church leaders, teachers, proclaimers, pundits for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today, as usual, is Althea Spencer-Miller and Josh Davis. Hello.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, everyone.
Wonderful to be with you all again. So today we are looking at Proper 24, the Sunday closest to October 19th. So the propers today continue in track one following Exodus 33. And this is Althea's point about the Israelites getting to know God, even as they are forming themselves as a nation, becomes acute. This seems to be the limits to the knowledge of God or the vision of God or the apprehension of God that the Israelites are going to experience, because Moses is testing how much of God's presence, God's reality he can bear. And the answer is not very much, because God sets some limits. So that's just thanks to Althea, able to follow up on that from last week. Can I jump right away to Isaiah 45, which is in track two, because that's just a fabulous alternative to Exodus. I like to have my cake and eat it. In this case, what we have is second Isaiah saying to Cyrus, who has no idea of what's about to happen, or probably won't ever know anything about the Isaianic narrative. Cyrus has become the anointed one of the Israelite God, and God's agency through Cyrus is going to do something completely different, completely different. It doesn't make it clear. Isaiah 45, 1-7 doesn't make it clear what's going to happen, but basically what's going to happen is that Cyrus, as the anointed, the chosen one of God, will make it possible for the Israelites in exile to return back and rebuild Israel. But that's not revealed here, as I said. Anyway, the fantastic line, apart from the anointing, the recognition of Cyrus as anointed, is the last line. I form, says God, I form light and create darkness. I make weal and create woe. I, the Lord, do these things. If you're going to have one God responsible for everything, then a line like this is the only possible line from which we can spin out some interpretations. I create evil and good. So, let's see. 1 Thessalonians, fabulous. This is where the New Testament begins. There's no such thing as the New Testament in the first century when Paul was writing with Silvanus and Timothy to the Thessalonians. If Thessalonians is the oldest book in the New Testament, the 27 books of the New Testament, this is where it all begins. And this is the opening of that first letter of Paul to the Thessalonians. I cherish it in that regard. It's the threefold voice, Paul, Silvanus, and Timothy. Pretty soon, Silvanus and Timothy will drop off. But I love the way Paul tries to start off this bending of the genre of letter writing, which is ubiquitous in the ancient world, into a format written by three people. You can see this in the we. We give thanks for your work. We know that God has chosen you, and you became imitators of all three of us. You know what kind of persons we were among you for yours. In other words, this is all about plurality and the example that presumably all three of them are giving, not only to the people in Thessaloniki, but also the Thessalonians, the people in Thessaloniki to whom the letter is written, will demonstrate to the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. The gospel, Matthew 22, a sort of equivocating answer Jesus gives to the Pharisees who are plotting to entrap Jesus. So knowing that they are going to entrap Jesus, he basically says allegiance, as demonstrated by both sides of the coin, is both to the emperor and to God. And you decide what things belong to the emperor and what things belong to God. So I don't think this becomes a principle by which we can order our tax returns or something like that. I think really what we have to keep in mind is the first line. The intention by this group of Pharisees in and around the temple where we've been for several weeks to entrap and snare Jesus in what he said. In other words, this is not an open question. So we could discuss that aspect of the gospel. Is that enough to start with, or what else do you think you would like to discuss?
Well, I just want to say that I don't know how we can not talk about the render unto the emperor the things that are the emperor's, right? It's such an important passage that gets read in certain ways. Discussing it, I think, is particularly important. So just flagging that, we don't have to pick that up right now, but I just want to make sure that we do discuss it.
Yep. It's definitely the Matthean community accommodating the language of kingship, the ruling power.
I'm happy that for us to follow that lead.
Well, I wonder if there's a consensus on how to interpret this among New Testament scholars, because it's one of the, like Romans 13, it's one of those passages that you have to interpret within a wider context. And so this is often read as like, okay, so give the coin's got his picture on it, give it to him, and then God apparently has laid claim to something else, some other domain or something. But I don't think that's necessarily I don't think that would be particularly worthy of amazement in terms of an answer. Actually, that's a pretty mundane answer if you think about it, I guess, right?
Yes. Remembering this is a trick question, we could look at the wider gospel, which is what I always try to do. There's a great passage in Matthew which demonstrates the importance of Peter, as we already know in Matthew's gospel. Peter says, Jesus, go to the sea and bring out the fish, and inside the fish you will find the coin, and the coin will pay the temple tax. So, in other words, that juxtaposed with the Matthew 22 reading suggests that there are several different sources of finance for the Matthean community. That would be one entry point into that discussion. But Althea, I'm sure you have other things in mind.
Not necessarily. It's a puzzling kind of saying. And when you combine it as you just did with taking the coin out of the fish's mouth and having it available to pay taxes, getting past the thought of sort of mythic nature of that action, mm-hmm. you know, it pushes towards a sense that there is nothing in the earth that is not a provision of God's.
Right.
And therefore the proprietorship of everything is God's, the rightful ownership, the rightful generativity of everything is sort of God's. So does that make this bifurcation, the emperor and God, an artifice? Is it a strategic survival necessity to make that distinction? In order to live within the empire, is there a kind of facetiousness in the God, the things that are God's? What does it call these people to? Are some of the things I think about, and I don't have any real clarity on which direction to go with those options. But that starts for me from aligning it with the text you mentioned. Those things are not necessarily self-evident in this Matthew 22, 15 to 22 passage.
There's also a parable about somebody who finds treasure in a field that has been bought. And this is a cause for great rejoicing and a cause for selling everything you have in order to have this treasure. So there are these anomalous discoveries of wealth in both the parables of Jesus in Matthew and the stories of what it makes me think of is going through the streets of New York City and finding coins or finding dollar bills floating around. We once found $50 floating through the air on Riverside Drive one cold December night. So that's not really a helpful analogy, but it is the surprise of the discovery that we might have in mind. I think the accommodation that Althea is pointing to is inevitable. It's inevitable. But there's so much more that is not about accommodation. And that has to do with the entrapment of the Pharisees in verse 15, mm-hmm. Their deceit. Perhaps that is the cause for their amazement, that he's managed to identify a way to satisfy people who want to have the Sadducees are now silent. People who now want to pay taxes, or at least want to accommodate themselves in peace to the empire. But very shortly in chapter 23, which is not read in this whole lectionary cycle, he's going to have some really, really critical things to say about the Pharisees and the Sadducees. It's a series of woes.
Yeah.
Just a catastrophic denunciation. So, I mean, I just don't see, if you look at the wider passage and not just the lectionary choice, how it's not much more problematic than the simple solution of you pay this here and you pay that there.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that unless the Pharisees were crazy at this point, the idea that this question could possibly entrap Jesus has to be located in some kind of controversy or ambivalence that existed in amongst the people, the Israelites, the Jews, in relation to the empire. And Deirdre, you might be able to speak more to this than I can. It's a question of what does payment of taxes and perhaps the entire coinage system around it, what does a payment of taxes mean for Jewish autonomy, Jewish religious rights, Jewish fidelity to Yahweh, yep. And how to exercise that in the face of an imposing empire like the Roman Empire? Or is this maybe a little unhelpfully? I'm also grappling with aspects of that time where there's a middle person in Israel. There's a temple system that also has its own taxations, and the relationship between that temple system and paying taxes to Rome. You know, what kinds of controversies would make the Pharisees think that they could entrap Jesus with a question like that?
It looks, well, there's a Galilean figure called Judas who refused to pay taxes to Rome, and this was in 6 of the Common Era, and Josephus reports it in Wars of the Jews, second book, and so on. And his refusal to pay taxes was a call to revolution. So it could be something that in the broader context of revolts might be taken as a signal. On the other hand, clearly there are whole bunches of people who don't want necessarily to automatically pay taxes to the emperor, or you wouldn't have the strange little story about the coin in the fish's mouth, which is a whole other way of circumventing demand.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's not what we used to call a farthing in the UK money pre-decimal system. You know, it's a silver coin in the fish's mouth. You know, it's like a $50 bill in the upper reaches of Manhattan. So, it seems like there are ordinary people who resent very much the taxes that Rome levies.
Yeah, and I think between you and Josh, you also pointed out that this is not necessarily, Jesus' answer here is not necessarily and instruction for all time. And so we've been spending some time contextualizing it greatly. If I leap forward into the present time, then I would caution perhaps about aligning the answer either with a progressive understanding of taxes, whatever that is, or with a conservative understanding of taxes. Because I'm not sure the terms of the conversation are the same now and then. So caution in bringing it forward is what I'm opening up. But to return to that past and to just flag what I think you have been mapping, Deirdre, that there is something of a resistance going on within the Methian community. And it has to be it has to be put in terms not of individual freedoms nor even individual responsibilities to the collective, but to a collective sense of who the Jews are as a people, with all their fracture lines, and how paying taxes represents something about their history of subjugation, conquest, or being conquered, and having to kowtow to these empires along the way.
I have a question as well about the clarity about the fish and the silver coin, but it seems to me that there's the entrapment component of the Pharisees that's at work, but there's also the fact that they're amazed by his answer, so that suggests that his answer is saying something to me more than just, give to God the spiritual and give to Caesar the material, because that's if that's what he's saying, then that's not a particularly that's not even a particularly interesting idea, I don't think. That's just a way of like trying to have your cake and eat it, it seems like to me. And so which is I think how this is interpreted, but that's not most often interpreted, but it's not actually an interesting response, certainly not worthy of amazement. If someone said that to me, I would think like, oh, well, they're just okay, whatever. So it seems like there's something more going on there in terms of amazement, and then casting it in the context of rebellions around the tax, paying the tax. It's also helpful because clearly that's what they're attempting to entrap him with, right? But they also, it seems like they have a particular answer that they're expecting. And somehow he's able to evade both getting in trouble, giving an answer that would get him in trouble with Rome, but also not exactly saying what they're expecting. So I'm interested in kind of thinking that through. But Deirdre, you went directly to the temple tax in the fish's mouth as well, and then talking about serendipity and that sort of thing. Can you flesh out those connections? I mean, obviously it's about the tax, but what is it that you're seeing there as instructive with regard to how to interpret this particular passage?
Well, I also linked it to the discovery of treasure in a field.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it isn't an isolated instance. And if I were to construct a better answer than I can give you at the moment, Josh, I would look at all places where wealth is discovered in strange ways that show it's part of the community and it's shared, but it's not produced in the ordinary way by which you work very hard and you get paid for the work that you've done. I would look at Matthew 20. We've discussed this, the way that the people who come last to the labor in the vineyard actually get paid the same. Anyway, I would take a bigger look at that. But I also just want to flag your point about astonishment.
I'm still unclear, just about this before you do. Why do you want to go there to interpret this passage about the tax? That's the part that you wanted to go to, the question of like serendipitous.
Yes.
Discovery of wealth. Why is that instructive for you with regard to this question about the tax?
Because what the lectionary does is separate out the reading from the rest of the gospel. And I want to see every instance I can think of in the gospel to ask the question about how the community in Matthew might be organizing itself economically.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm trying to do. So I'm always trying to counteract the fragmentation.
Right. And what is it about how the community uses money that is helpful for interpreting this pericope?
It helps us see that the reaction of amazement is the result of some immediacy that would not characterize the reaction of the Matthean community were we to take the rest of these examples in the gospel itself. In other words, I think I would have to make the case, and I haven't made the case. I think that probably what I could argue is that the providence of God is such that the Matthean community is freed up to think not just about the fact that they don't have to worry about earning money because God so cares for the flowers of the field and the birds of the air and much more you, mm-hmm. people of little faith. That's to go back to the Sermon on the Mount. But they're freed up to think about other much more significant things than the allegiance they might owe to the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just build on that and say that this reaction in verse 22 of the amazement of the Pharisees, mm-hmm. it might not just be amazement at the answer, it might be amazement at the recognition that Jesus, whom they've characterized as someone who is sincere, he teaches the way of God in accordance with the truth, has actually cottoned on to their duplicity and deceit. But I want to flag it also because in the next passage, which we're going to look at next week, there's a whole bunch of Sadducees who have reappeared in the narrative, and they ask about a woman who was married to seven husbands in succession, and in the resurrection they want to know, because Sadducees don't believe in resurrection, whose wife will she be? And he gives them an answer, which I'm not going to go into here because we'll discuss it next week, that causes the whole crowd to be astounded at his teaching. It's a different verb.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that if you think amazement is worth flagging, just wait till we discuss the astounded nature of the crowd. Not the Pharisees or the Sadducees, but the crowd. When we get to Jesus' teaching about the marriage of the woman in the resurrected life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very helpful, because it's to say that whatever is going on in the text with regard to this particular money ought to be interpreted in the wider scheme of how the money is being discussed in Matthew overall. And that's why I think that the answer that he gives is well, first of all, what I see in it is that consistently, it seems like Jesus is always able to, I find it oftentimes when I see these encounters with Pharisees, I sort of imagine that they're putting to him a question of like, whose side are you on, right? Are you on the side of Moses, or are you on the side of idols, or something like this, like the true God or the false God? And that's epitomized in this coin and in this tax and in everything. So they're asking him to take a stand on it, and that his answer in some ways turns that around on them, because they believe that they stand with Moses and Torah. They know where the Sadducees are, and they don't have a particularly high regard for the Sadducees' position, which just seems, you know, facile accommodationism, and, you know, we're willing to call Zeus and Yahweh the same, and these kinds of things. But that his way of responding turns it around on them, but turns it around on them in such a way that it becomes impossible for them to avoid appearing that they're on the side of the enemy rather than on Moses themselves, whom they think they've sided with. And seems to me that there's something like that going on here, because it's like you all are fixated on what whose coin this is, right? But you're, or whether or not we as Jews should be subject to a foreign power and should be offering this, especially when this guy presents himself as a god of some kind. And so whose side are you on? You on the real God, or are you on the side of the real God, or are you on the side of this false God? And are you trafficking in that and paying it? And it looks like what he does is flip that to say, well, what is really entailed in being devoted to the true God versus the false God, and how could you distinguish between whose is whose? Obviously, what is Caesar's is God's. And it seems to me that that sort of answer enables him to turn it around so that they have to answer it, that, of course, this is God's, but it also evades their trap because he doesn't actually say, don't pay the tax. but I don't know what that has to do with whether the tax is paid or not, because it seems like he evades that question too. Do you follow what I'm driving at?
Yep, I do.
Yeah. To complicate it some more, another piece of this, I was just paying attention to the first two sentences.
Yeah, yeah.
That the Pharisees orchestrated, not only to the method by which the entrapment was done, was not only in terms of a specific question, but in terms of the people who carried the question to Jesus. So disciples of the Pharisees are one group, Herodians are another group. And I think it's fair to say that both groups, both Pharisees and Herodians, were interested in the autonomy of Israel, of the Jews, but with different perspectives on how that autonomy ought to be achieved or sustained, with the Pharisees being more within the Orthodox traditions of Judaism, and perhaps the Herodians. I think the history of the Herodians coming out of the Maccabean Revolution was a group that had in some way betrayed the orthodoxy of Israel and were more manipulable by the Roman Empire than the Pharisees were, so to speak. So another perspective on it is that the question of taxes may not be so much a literal question as an encoded question that manifests in some ways which side Jesus would come down on, and perhaps address issues of his popularity, not necessarily with Rome, but with the Jewish people. Because the approach of Pharisaic disciples and Herodians really puts him in the crux of a heated disagreement amongst the Jews themselves. So to think through his answer and the kind of deftness or agility that the answer performs might also be helped by contextualizing the encounter historically in that way.
Yeah, and there's one more tiny point, which is that the word to entrap him is actually not just slipping on a banana peel or tripping over a pavement while you're looking at your iPhone. It's actually the snare to death. So it's from a verb that describes ensnaring birds to take them into places where they do not naturally exist, to entrap birds so that they can be eaten, to noose animals and so that they are captured and killed. Do you see what I mean? So it's a really life-threatening action.
So tell us now, do you intend to pack the Supreme Court? Like that kind of
Exactly.
No, if you say no, then you're going to lose a lot of your base. If you say yes, then you're caught up in having to defend and explain a whole slew of things that potentially both, you know, it's a trap either way, right? Yeah. What can I ask interpretively, like grammatically? So they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians, saying. So what is that along with the Herodians saying? Are the Herodians with the disciples of the Pharisees? What exactly is happening there?
There are separate groups, but as Alpheus pointed out, the Pharisees and the Herodians seem to be aligned at this point and separate from the Sadducees. Mm-hmm. So that it looks like the Pharisees are the more dominant political and religious reality, and the Herodians represent the political affiliation. Is that a way to put it?
Yes. And I think grammatically, if I heard your question right, Josh, then yes, the Pharisees are the choreographers of this scene. And interestingly, it's to go with your example too, Josh. Interestingly, it's like ex-Republicans or disgruntled Republicans joining into to work with Biden, to vote for and support Biden for some bigger good. Then it's interesting that the Herodians would be going along with the Pharisees' plot at this point. But it does seem grammatically that the Pharisees sent their disciples and the Herodians together.
Right. And it seems like those different how you interpret that suggests like kind of what's going on. Like, because it could be that the Herodians and the Pharisees' disciples are on the same page with respect to this question and are trying to entrap him. Or it could be that like they both represent different opinions on the question. The Herodians are on one side and the Pharisees on another. I don't know a lot about this, but you know, the Herods weren't fond of them. At least I don't think of the Pharisees as being fond of the Herodians. Is that right?
No, I think this looks like some expedient situation here. Yeah.
They want to get rid of this guy. And
Yeah.
And so they're going to put this question to him.
Yeah, I mean, we never see congenial relations between any of the Herod family and followers of Jesus. You know, John the Baptist beheaded. It's just, there's no negotiation there with apocalyptic prophets.
Right. Exactly. So in many ways, trying to get him to say something along the lines of something that would get him killed in the same way that John the Baptist got killed. But we also get, and this is where I was leading. I mean, all of the Gospels in some way signal the cleansing of the temple as, you know, the facilitating event of his arrest and trial. And obviously this is connected to that. And that's the other thing about, they're amazed at his response, but also there's a situation where the exchange of money must take place and those kinds of things in order to be able to, and he's clearly cleansing the temple. It seems like there's just so much going on here. And it seems like his answer to this question is one that's like, it says one thing, but it also says the opposite at the same time, but not in a way that's saying you can divide it up. It's that to answer, give to Caesar's what is Caesar's and God's what is God's, it can be read in one way, which will get him off of their hook, but it also doesn't compromise with regard to God's God. Well, I mean, I don't want to use the term dominion, but that idea of like, of course, the whole, everything belongs to God, right? In the same way that the Isaiah passage is pointing to, there is one God, But I'm getting the sense that maybe I'm in the minority here in thinking and reading it this way.
It's very hard, Josh, to summarize 2,000 years of interpretation. But fortunately, you know, we can just pick and choose in this kind of podcast, you know, ways we might want to read it and so on. So I can't summarize 2,000 years, but I don't disagree with the way in which Jesus avoids, he passes between Scylla and Charybdis by doing this. Yes.
And I do think there's a way in which it's a very simple answer in a way. On the surface, it's a very simple answer. And it's one of those answers that you suspect it's a tip of the iceberg. That its very simplicity hides a lot of complexity underneath it. And, you know, when you're talking about 2,000 years of interpretation, we're not the only ones privileged to pick and choose, because this text, this passage, offers many entry points. You know, there is the collusion between the Pharisees and the Herodians. There is the simplicity and profundity of Jesus's answer. There is the Roman Empire. There is how are taxes paid by Jews to the empire, by Jews to the temple system. But then it's very interesting, and we may not have enough time to make sense of this, that there is something of a rebuttal against the question and against what I suspect to be their very insincere piety in asking the question. Yep. That when Jesus asks them to show the coin used for the tax, they bring him a denarius. Mm-hmm. What does it mean that the denarius is a Roman coin? And that these Jews themselves, who seem to be interested in protecting their Jewish ways in the question, bring to Jesus a denarius. Does that kick the question back into their court? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, does it reveal their hypocrisy?
Yeah.
You know, what exactly is it that they're amazed at?
Right. Since you have the tax coin, you should pay the tax. You know, and stop asking deceitful questions.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus is an itinerant peasant. He doesn't carry around coins. Yeah.
I think that Jesus is opposed to paying the tax. that's what I'm saying. And I think his answer says that. That's what I'm driving at. I think we want to see him as like parsing it in such a way that it's easy for him to do this and do that. And I think he turns it around on them to say, like, well, who's the real monotheist here? Right? You've got the coin and you're asking me what you should do with it. But, you know, if you're posing it to me and so to say, are you on Moses' side or are you on Pharaoh's side? He turns it around and says, well, you guys are, I'm with Moses here, right? And it's that would be shocking to them, I would think, if his answer was such that it revealed that. But he says it in a way that allows him to evade getting in trouble with Rome while demonstrating to them that they're not the monotheists that they believe themselves to be.
That's a tone of voice. It's sort of the difference between give therefore to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God, the things that are God's. Mm-hmm. As against, I'll use a little imposition. You idiots.
Right, right. and the answer that they give to that question will place them as good Jews or right? Based on, like, well, oh, so this is, okay, so this is Caesar's, right? Well, okay, well, but I thought the whole earth was God's, right? Right?
Right.
So it puts them in a position where they out themselves.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And then the point would be that everything, as you said, Josh, belongs to God. Everything, including things that don't know it, like
the emperor.
Like Cyrus, like yeah. Cyrus the
Great. Right.
Like them emperors, yes.
Yes.
Right.
I have to go. I'm so sorry. This is just, as usual, a fantastic discussion. Okay, so hold that thought, people, and let's meet again next week.
Because it's, yeah, apparently it's going to be great next week, too. So
really great. Stay tuned. Thank you both immensely.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.